Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Friday, June 7th, 2024. Joining me for today's podcast are Stuart Walpin, who scribes for Popular Mechanics, AARP, Techlicious, Investopedia, and other terrific publications. Rob Peguero, who writes about tech developments at PC Mag, Fast Company, and other publications, is along here with us. Dwight Silverman, the veteran technology journalist for the Houston Chronicles. We were just talking about how hot it is in Las Vegas and in Houston. I'll bring up Las Vegas in a second. And John Quinn, who usually joins the podcast, who writes for the New York Times, Smart Cities, and Time Guides, is on assignment. So, gentlemen, how are you each doing today?
Very well.
Very good.
Well, you'll notice my backdrop has changed. I am now firmly ensconced in good old Las Vegas, Nevada, Summerlin specifically, which is about 15 miles outside of Las Vegas. It's a very chilly 100 degrees out here, but like Houston, chatting with Dwight before the podcast. I lived in Houston for 10 years. You've been in Houston most of your life, haven't you, Dwight? If I'm not mistaken,
most of my professional life, yes.
Yeah. So everything is air conditioned, but you don't get the humidity out here, which is interesting. You know. So anyway, we'll see how. Hopefully, I don't turn into a godfather like gambler over the next few months. I doubt that will happen. Although I now can bet on the Yankees, which I may do this weekend. Using my DraftKings app, because of course you know I'm in a location right now that gambling is legal, but not that I would ever do anything like that. But anyway, excited to do the podcast today and get going on that. We only have a couple topics here. Let me bring that up here, and of course we had to do this one. We've got WWDC, which is starts early next week. This is, I think, one of the more hotly anticipated WWDCs, not because they're all consequential, of course, but this is a pretty big one. And I think the reason for this, and I'm sure each of you folks are going to agree with me, is that there's a perception. It was an excellent article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, the day before, about, you know, kind of positioning Apple as kind of behind the eight ball, you know, from others, Google, Microsoft, others, in terms of what are they going to do about AI. And we've talked about this before in previous podcasts. Apple has really been somewhat shy about using the phrase AI. In fact, they rarely use that. They have done some interesting things with Siri that does have AI functionality. But there's a perception, I believe, that, you know, Apple is behind the eight ball. So there's some pretty high expectations. Now, a lot of things have been leaking out from a rumor standpoint. I saw a rumor this morning that they're going to refer to AI as Apple Intelligence. God bless Apple, you know. So we'll see how they get along with that. But let me start with Dwight and get your perspective, Dwight, on WWDC, what you expect to hear, and you know your overall kind of prognostications about what we may stumble upon when they kind of open the curtain on everything.
Well, I think that one of the interesting things about Apple is it tends, first of all, to come in late to things anyway. When it does come in, it attempts to do them better in a more seamless form than anybody else. And I've got to say that a lot of the things I've seen in terms of companies like Samsung and its other rivals, Google, is doing AI in kind of a, hey, look, here's AI. And when you use it, it gives you that feel, you know, it's not seamless. And from what Mark Gurman had a really good roundup today in Bloomberg about all the things that it's expected to do. And it looks like Apple is going to try to stay true to form, whereas opposed to doing the razzle dazzle, it's going to be utilitarian. It's going to make your life easier. It'll be more proper. And again, it'll be for Apple, it'll be its early days. And right. This is what Apple does best, you know, is it comes in and it, you know, it just works. The thing about AI is that it generally does not have the reputation of just working. It hallucinates, it makes stuff up, it screws up your hands when you try to do, you know, an image. So there's a lot of issues with it. I also read a piece that talked about it's very unusual for Apple to adopt technology that it doesn't feel it can perfect. or yes. being close to perfection. And yes. so it'll be interesting to see how it deals with that. But I'm looking forward to having maybe a Siri that actually works.
Well, I mean, if you believe some of the rumors out there, and I didn't read the Bloomberg piece, but apparently there is some noise out there that Apple's going to focus on relatively narrow usage models like meeting summaries, you know, using Safari and using Siri presumably for that. Now that, you know, that has its own implications because, yes, you know, AI can be an enormous help from a note-taking standpoint and meeting summaries, but that, you know, gets into that privacy issue. You know, and a lot of companies right now love the idea of AI. They're not really that crazy about discussing things that, you know, company secrets in a meeting that may get compromised. So that's a kind of a case for doing things locally, which obviously right. Qualcomm is pushing with their solutions in terms of they having really, really powerful AI-based processors that can do a lot of the work locally. There's latency advantages, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, among the things they've been talking about, and Gurman mentions this, is that, you know, Apple has reportedly signed a deal with OpenAI to do a chatbot. And in that and the other components, all of it, you can turn it off. If you don't want AI on your iPhone, you'll be able to shut it down. And I think, again, you know, that fits. Apple will make sure that you understand that some of what it's doing is not going to be on the device. But you can bet that's what they're working towards long term, is that all of this eventually ends up being done on device.
So Stuart, do you expect, and I think I know what your answer is going to be, but do you expect them to spend a disproportionate amount of time because of their reputation with people over trust and privacy? Not that they're perfect in that area, but if you compare Apple to some of the other big players out there, Apple does have a pretty envious reputation with consumers over privacy protection and things like that. Do you think they'll spend quite a bit of time on that to emphasize that hey, we're approaching AI, whatever they call AI, in a responsible way? What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I think they're actually going to call it Apple AI. That's what I've been hearing through the tea leaves or seeing through the tea leaves. They're going to call it Apple AI. One of the things, I don't think they'll spend an inordinate amount of time. I think they'll remind people that unlike Google and to a lesser extent Samsung, that privacy.
Hey, folks, this is Mark Vina, CEO of Smart Tech Research. Smart Tech Research is proud to have Aura sponsoring my Smart Tech Check podcast. Aura Security Software is the all-in-one digital safety net for the whole family. It's literally like having a personal cyber guardian that protects all of the devices in your home on a 24/7 basis. What's more, its AI functionality stands out as it constantly learns and adapts to threats, keeping your family and you safe around the clock. It's a must-have solution for anyone serious about online security. Stay tuned for a special no-obligation promo offer for Aura that will give you cybersecurity peace of mind.
Hi, I'm Anna with Smart Tech Research. Whether you're browsing the web, checking emails, monitoring your children's online behavior, spam calls and identity protection, and conducting online transactions, Aura has your back, ensuring a secure and seamless experience every time. Aura's comprehensive security solutions are compatible with Microsoft Windows, Apple Mac OS, Android, iOS, and iPad OS devices. For an exclusive 14-day no-obligation trial version of Aura, use the on-screen QR code or visit the website shown here. Aura is the smart, simple way to stay safe online.
Is an important aspect of what they're going to do. But the thing that strikes me about what's going on here is a number of things. One, that they had been developing AI quite a bit as part of their car project, which they abandoned, and then imported all those AI people from the car project over onto the OS side. So that's some of it is going to be internally developed.
Oh, yeah.
The thing is,
yeah,
is that it's very unusual. They signed a deal with, as Dwight says, with OpenAI, and I think they've also are working with ChatGPT for something called AppleGPT. But it's very unusual for Apple to bring in companies to provide technology without first buying the company supplying it so they can claim complete ownership over the technology. Almost a lot of the technology in the iPhone was not developed in-house, but out like the touchscreen was right. developed by outside companies that Apple just bought. So I think it's going to be I think that's an awkward setup for Apple to start with, because they don't own, they won't own a lot of the technologies that they'll be deploying, and how they manage to carry that out in terms of usability, in terms of privacy, in terms of all those things, I think has to remain to be seen, because they don't own the companies that they're working with, which is very unusual for Apple. So I don't mention privacy, because that's what they do, and that's their big selling point is privacy. I don't think they'll spend an inordinate amount of time on it. I think they're going to spend an inordinate amount of time catching up to both Google and Samsung, who have been making huge AI plays. And I agree with Dwight that a lot of it will be utilitarian as opposed to AI. Look, we have AI, which right. is essentially what both Samsung and Google have done, where Apple will simply say, we're going to make things easier for you to do by doing X, Y, and Z, and not even mention AI in the kind of billboardy way that both Apple, both Google and Samsung have.
Right. And to be clear, if you saw the Google I/O event a couple of weeks ago, even some of the other industry scale events, you know, there's more focus on the flash and the sizzle than there is on, hey, here's two or three practical applications. Not to say there aren't any, there are, but you know, I think the Apple modus operandi is to really focus on things that move the needle and make sense and resonate with people.
Well, one of the things that I'm really looking forward to, from what I understand that they're going to use AI for, is improve the dictation capabilities of notes, which would be a huge boon, at least to all of us.
Right. Yes. Correct. What, Robert, your take?
Yeah. So I was at Google I/O, and the one AI demonstration where I thought this would actually address a problem I have is have AI tell me summarize a lot of different emails at once. The example they had was, you know, there's this thread among five different people about scheduling something. The example that made me think of was actually in your neighborhood, CES. I want a mail program to tell me, these are the things you could do Tuesday night. And apparently mail will have some sort of summarization feature as a result of this Apple intelligence, which would be good, because the other problem with Apple's mail client is the search feature on it sucks. So they have to do better with that. And whether it's something they've bought from OpenAI or developed in-house, that seems like a good practical application, and would necessarily have to run on device, because mail is something that you run on your iPad, iPhone, or Mac. So I like that idea.
And Rob, hey, listen, you just kind of got my brain going. I would, if they develop some type of calendaring capability in Apple Mail, and I would actually walk away from Microsoft Outlook if this was the case, that allowed me to say, hey, here's a bunch of meetings at CES that are in different locations. Help me coordinate my schedule and put those meetings in places like at the convention center. I'll be at this hotel on Tuesday. That would be humongous. So
yeah. Otherwise, cool. I'm literally like putting together like some sort of spreadsheet. Okay, this is what I could do Tuesday at 5 o'clock, right. 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock.
Correct.
So I like that idea. We'll see. I have other things I'd like to see at WWDC, but I bet I won't. Like, I'm going to bet there still won't be a kids mode for iPadOS. So if you want to hand your tablet to your tween, you'll still have to hope that they don't tweet as you.
Interesting. No, I think you're all correct. I mean, from a hardware standpoint, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of hardware announced. If
anything. Not expected. Yeah, not expected.
I don't think you're going to see a lot of stuff there, but you know, I really think the interesting thing is that since they have an ecosystem that the other PC OEMs would love to have, I mean, they can do things in a seamless way where your experience is consistent, whether it's a tablet, a smartphone, whether it's a desktop as well, because I still use a desktop like all of you do. But it'll be very interesting. Just before we leave the topic here, do you think we'll see any – if you had a bet on a surprise, Dwight, like, you know, kind of a – not a, you know, one more thing, or the thing that Jobs used to say, you know, at the end of his presentation. Yeah, exactly. Do you think, right? Let me just each of you. Do you think we'll see?
This is more of a wish than a bet. But okay. You know, I bought the new iPad Pro with the M4 chip, That is a fantastic machine. The more I use it, the better, the more I love it. And, you know, there's been a lot of wishful thinking that Apple would allow you to run the Mac OS on it. Well, I don't think that that's going to happen, at least, you know, immediately. What I would love to see is a real advance in iPad OS that greatly improves its multitasking capability, allows for things like Rob said, like a kids mode, you know, a big leap in iPad OS. And I think one of the reasons why they may have released it with this chip early is because that is indeed coming, that there is something that they want to do with it that they'll unveil, that the M4 chip will make
possible. Like a calculator app for iPad OS.
Yes. Please, at least that.
Finally get the processing power to fulfill their dreams they've always had for this thing.
So Rob, is that your desire, your wish, that they would come out with a calculator app?
Actually, one thing, this is a Mac OS thing. Somebody at Apple needs to look at why Safari is the world's most powerless browser when it comes to memory hogging websites. I have to quit that thing multiple times a day. I just did at the start of this podcast recording, so it does not bog down my entire Mac, because like a PDF is suddenly eating up a gigabyte of memory for God knows why.
Stuart, what is your wish before we leave?
Well, I wish that they would stop naming Mac OS after geographical features or animals, especially if they're going to now add AI, which is a big leap forward. So I hope that they have a big leap forward in the naming of the OS, which has always confused me, as well as the numbering system. We're going to get iOS 18 on the iPhone 16. I wish that they would bring those two into alignment so I didn't have to remember these two different numbers. So I know that the iPhone whatever is the same number as the damn operating system, so I don't have to keep remembering which operating system I'm running. The second thing is, I'm really pissed off. I really wanted to get a Mac Studio, but I don't want the M2, which is now going to be 2 years old by the time the M4 Studio comes out next year. And I'm between this rock and a hard place because I need a new computer, but I don't want an M2 if I know the M4 is coming. So I'm crossing my fingers that there'll be an M4 Mac Studio at WWDC, but I'm not holding out any hope for
it. You and I have talked about that for years. Apple has their own cadence. It's certainly not the way that processors are rolled out on the PC side. When Intel or whoever makes an announcement, they trickle down to just about every platform instantaneously. Apple marches to their own drum. I've never quite understood that.
Maybe especially putting the M4 on the iPad first instead of a laptop or a desktop.
Yes, because technically speaking, the iPad Pro, the model that Dwight is referring to, is the most powerful device in their portfolio, which is kind of
weird.
Right,
and I can't use it as my desktop, so what's the point?
Okay, let's go to, and this is a topic that you'd like to tee off on, Rob, is the rise of fixed wireless access. You know, Dwight will probably have something to say about this as well when we go into the broadband topic, but you've been covering this quite a bit. And let's explain to the audience what fixed wireless access is so people kind of understand that first and foremost.
So fixed wireless access, or FWA, is 5G, but to a large antenna in your house. And it's become the most popular form of broadband in terms of new subscribers over the past couple of years. Certainly last year, looking at the total net growth in broadband subscriptions in the U.S., all of it was fixed wireless, and almost all of that was T-Mobile, followed by Verizon, at the expense of cable operators and people on slower connections like DSL. Now, just this week, the research firm OpenSignal came out with a really interesting study of how fixed wireless has fared in the U.S., and the top line number that really jumped out at me was how many more people had a choice of broadband. By their estimate, 40 million more households who were once stuck in local monopolies now have the luxury, if they want, of firing their previous provider, in most cases a cable company. That's great. And that is, you know, for years people have said, what exactly does 5G do? Like, it's not making my car drive itself. Here you go. It's giving you a chance to fire whatever provider you had at home that you hated, but you couldn't do anything about. So that's great. And it also helps that both T-Mobile and Verizon, they have really simple pricing. There isn't the rate that explodes in 12 or 24 months. There's not a data cap. There's not an equipment fee. All the stuff that people hate about what a lot of cable providers think people actually like, they don't do. So this is great. It's technology not living up to its advanced hype, because I don't remember people talking about this at wireless industry conferences in like 2018, but addressing a real problem people have. And it's gotten to the point where just now T-Mobile has rolled out a internet backup service, which you really shouldn't subscribe to it. If your ISP is so unreliable, you want to spend an extra $30 to have a backup, you should fire that ISP and just sign up with T-Mobile already. AT&T also now has its own Internet Air service, which they're rolling out in addition to what's become a very big fiber build-out by them. And so in conclusion, it's exciting to cover good news in residential broadband, because for so long there has not been a whole lot. It's been the people don't have it, or they're stuck with one company they may not love all that much. So yay, the system works.
Well, you know, I speaking to someone who just moved away from San Jose, where the place I lived in, which was all of maybe 5 miles away from the Apple campus, and I lived in San Jose for 17 years, you had one choice, and that was Comcast. And they've made, you know, they've made some improvements, but, you know, now that I'm using fiber with Cox out in Las Vegas, it's like my life has changed. You know, I don't think I could ever move to a geographic location without fiber. But certainly fixed wireless access has the potential of serving a lot of customers who don't, there's no, fiber's not, is not, because that's an expensive installation. Yep. For a lot of companies to put that infrastructure in. Stuart, what's your thought on that? I mean, you're a New Yorker, you know, you're in, who are you using, by the way? Is it Comcast?
Comcast isn't available in the city. It's at Long Island. In the city, it's either Spectrum, which I had, or thankfully, my neighborhood is now wired for Verizon Fios, which was a big step forward. I used to get an outage from Spectrum every month, and I've never gotten an outage. I think one outage in a year with Fios, and they fixed it right away. So I'm far happier with Fios. But I'm in sort of a team, even though I'm a T-Mobile subscriber for my phone, we're sort of in a T-Mobile desert. So I really, we got maybe two bars in the apartment, so I'm loath to switch to the fixed wireless. But fixed wireless was originally intended, and still is largely, a rural solution where that last mile wiring capability is very, very expensive. And unfortunately, in the cities where we have lots of choices, you know, just having the choice between Spectrum or Verizon is more than anybody out in the rural districts have. And as a result, the rural fixed wireless is still very expensive as compared to what we pay, because it's literally the only option. And it's the service still isn't as speedy as it would be in the cities. Now, whether or not the expansion of broadband, and of course, it doesn't help that the broadband subsidies just ended, which is even more crippling to a certain extent to both rural and urban customers. So the digital divide thing is still a huge topic that T-Mobile and the other fixed wireless companies are hoping to solve, but there is still a wide gap between what's available in the cities and in the suburbs than what's available in rural and especially inner cities.
Dwight, this is certainly going to dovetail into your topic next, but what's your perspective on the fixed wireless access topic versus, you know, fiber versus?
I think fixed wireless is a great option if you don't have many other options. It's problematic in all the ways that cellular data services are problematic. So, for example, in the condo complex I live in, our buildings, we have three buildings, two of them are on one block, and then the third building, the one I'm in, is in its own block. And I wrote about T-Mobile's when it in last year and tried it. And what's interesting is, our buildings face north, west, south, and east. And if you're a subscriber on the east side, you get a better signal than someone who's on the west side, because that's where it is. You know, there's no consistency to it. And it's good enough, you know, for most people. If you're streaming, though, you know, Stuart with his two bars is not going to be very happy kind of with the buffering. The other thing is, is both Verizon and T-Mobile, I don't know about AT&T, but both of them prioritize mobile customers on their towers. So at rush hour here, I live close to downtown. In rush hour here, the speed goes down as, you know, you get a bunch of cars on the street where T-Mobile customers using it. So So it has pros and cons to it. One interesting thing about rural, I just read this, there was a study this week from AllConnect that said that kind of what happened in Asia is starting to happen in America rural because of the Broadband Infrastructure Act. There, fiber, while it's expensive to lay, certainly in cities and rural areas where you just trench, lay it, and go to the house, is less expensive. And the average download speeds in these rural areas where fiber has been added is starting to go up to the point that in some areas, it is faster average download speeds than in nearby urban areas where you have a mix. So you're starting to see some benefits from that. But because of the distances, 5G fixed wireless is problematic as well in rural areas.
Well, again, I'm a huge believer. I know everything you guys have said is accurate, but I'm just a big believer that, you know, FWA has the ability to really create a lot more competition in the marketplace. You know, I mean, I look
that's
at
true. That's
from
true.
From a business standpoint. But let's dovetail now right into your topic. I mean, you've been covering the broadband topic for a long time, even more probably more heavily over the last year or so. You and I have had a number of offline conversations. Again, I never thought that I would be in such a heavenly state of mind from having a great internet connection. And again, this fiber optic is unbelievable. It really is. You know, I can't say enough about it. And the other interesting thing is why you and I talked about this when we were chatting about a month ago, right before I moved, I decided I'm going to cut the cord. Get rid of my my TV content component to my subscription with Comcast, and just go, you know, for a few weeks, go with a cord cutting mode with subscribing to YouTube TV. I think is what I used. I blew through the data cap in about a week and a half because of my old habit of leaving the TV on all the time, you know, and I would have, let's say, the news playing in a window on one of my computers, but it was always playing, like the news channel. And boy, did that not feel good, you know? So anyway, but let's get into it. And let's talk a little bit about some of the things that have caught your eye lately.
So I kind of became obsessed with broadband, in particular wired broadband, over the last probably year and a half. I got on the HOA board at this condo complex, and one of the things I discovered was that AT&T in a lot of markets, including Houston, will rewire older buildings for free if they think there will be enough uptake in subscriptions.
Yeah.
So we got them to do that here, and so it was turned on, you know, about maybe a month or so ago, and I've switched, and a lot of other people here have switched. But I learned so much about it.
But how long did that process take? You know, once
it was surprisingly fast. We've got 228 units in three buildings across two blocks, as I've described. They did it probably in a little more than a month. It was really impressive. Running the fiber through the attics, dropping it down. We've got three stories of units, three of each stack. And I was amazed at how fast they went. It was a team of three or four. And they did an excellent job. But one of the interesting things about it is it kind of made me like look harder at home internet and home broadband. And, you know, you mentioned, I think a lot of this has to do with two things. The fixed wireless adds another layer of competition. It puts the fear of God into the legacy providers, but also there's something else coming, very soon that is going to, on the cable side, that's going to kick it into further gear. So Comcast is in the process now of starting to roll out the next generation of cable modem service called DOCSIS 4. And DOCSIS 4 will essentially put cable service kind of feature for feature at parity with fiber. Symmetrical upload and download speeds, no data caps. Comcast, at least, is not will not charge for equipment rental. They told me that this week. So it's supposed to launch here in Houston in the second half of this year, which we're coming up on shortly. And they are also pricing it based on what they've got it rolled out in cities like Atlanta and Denver. And there it's priced very close, if not a little bit less than AT&T's fiber product. So you're about to see competition get even more intense. This is one of the reasons, I think, why AT&T has been so aggressive about expanding its fiber footprint, because they know what's coming from the cable providers.
See, you know, and what's interesting about that, going back to the cord cutting piece, is that there was a time, probably 3, 4, 5 years ago, where you could cut the cord and save money. And now that doesn't really, you know, if you're trying to kind of pretty much match your existing cable program lineup vis-a-vis a cord cutting program, my experience has been you're not really saving a whole lot of money. You know,
right. You have to kind of, you know, I started cutting the cord in 2013. And one of the things that I learned quickly and preached in the columns I did on it was that you really have to approach television very differently. Yes. And if you must have a cable-like package now, you won't save money. If you change kind of what you watch and kind of watch niche channels or get season passes to the shows you like, you still can save money. I mean, I run the numbers every year, and I save well over $1,000, $1,500 every year based on if I'm looking back at my previous cable thing. But if you watch it the way you do, Mark, and you want to be able to channel surf and have it on all the time, it's very difficult to save money.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's a behavioral thing, you know, and right. A younger user may not be consuming content just like that. My thought process is that as this battle of fiber versus DOCSIS 4.0, let's call that too broad approaches to delivering better broadband speeds, as competition increases and costs come down, you know, maybe what it does over the long term, it makes the cord cutting model a bit more, you know, attractive because the fact that your baseline cost is coming down. You know, but I don't know whether that's true or not. I haven't followed it that closely. If that's the case, Stuart, as we kind of bring the podcast to a conclusion here, what is your thought on just in general about cord cutting? You know, we talked about the fixed wireless access thing, and you know your feelings about that. But do you have any type of interesting perspectives on your particular usage that would help change the way you actually connect to the internet?
Well, I don't know that there are any changes the way that I would connect to the internet. Since I cover all of this or have to cover it, all of it, I have to dive into all of them at some point or another. And the cost to me is a tax deduction because I'm writing about it. So what occurs to me are two things. The first thing is how confusing this is to non-technical consumers. And the work that Dwight does and other of our ilk do to try to explain it is very helpful. But I run into consumers all the time who ask me, who don't know this industry, who don't know the difference. They only hear that, oh, it's fiber. And fiber versus broadband, aren't they the same thing? And what about TV? You know, they have all of these questions and no really easy to decipher answers in like you were just talking about, the fact you have to change your behavior to save money, which to me is insane. I should be able to get the same experience and be able to compare apples to apples in terms of, you know, what I'm going to buy. There isn't any other consumer product in the marketplace, even electronics, that is confusing as this to mainstream consumers, especially when they just passed the where you have to list the ingredients of your broadband service.
Broadband
labels. Tax label.
Right. Which will help, but the numbers are still confusing. The download speeds, what's a good? Somebody just asked me the other day, well, I have to, is 100 enough? And I'm telling him, yeah, 100 is plenty. Well, it doesn't sound like enough. And you know, everything about this is enormously confusing.
Well, and not only that, it's also the user experience. I mean, the one thing that drove me crazy when I switched from to the cord cutting model. I was, you know, the one thing I must say about Xfinity and Comcast, they have a really very intuitive user guide to record DVR content. It's very linear based, and they really nailed it. I found myself very challenged sometimes because I did not like the YouTube TV interface. I found it confusing, frankly. Ironically enough, Cox Communications leverages the same interface. That's exactly right. So, Rob, just to close us out on this, because you live in the swamp.
And I'm on a hill. The swamp is down that way.
you're very happy, by the way. You've always told me, you know, I like to be a swamp creature. What's your perspective from a user standpoint? Now you're in the thick of it, right? You could probably throw a rock at the Washington Monument from where you are. I mean, has your experience been unique given where you live physically, or, you know, what is your whole take on it? Are you just kind of happy with the choice?
So we've been very lucky, and, you know, as a couple and as a neighborhood, that we've Fios came here. It wasn't available at our house when we moved in, but once it was, I think around like 2009, 2010, I was like, yes, sign me up immediately. And it has been the most reliable form of broadband I've ever had. Granted, the competition before that was DSL. So, you know,
DSL.
Oh, wow. It has all these advantages. It is the uptime is fantastic. It has endless capacity. You don't have data caps with fiber because no one can seriously say, oh, it's a matter of fairness, which is Comcast's silly excuse for that. You know, I think to the extent that forces cable companies to level up, for instance, where you're at, Mark, Cox is now a fiber provider. A lot of cable companies are overbuilding fiber in their most dense neighborhoods to catch up that way. Comcast, it's funny, they had this whole dog and pony show at their Philadelphia headquarters in February where they talked about, here's our new Wi-Fi 7 router. You know, we're going to have all the speed, all these improvements. I'm like, what about your data cap? And then it turned out, oh, well, you have DOCSIS 4.0 service, but they're going to sell as X class. They don't have a data cap. They don't have an equipment fee. So they sort of have recognized that people don't like these things, but they just can't resist engaging in a little more rent seeking from customers who I guess don't know that these things aren't a fixed fact of broadband life. They're just a kind of artificial scarcity attacks a local monopolist is imposing on his customers. And then Comcast recognizes that that's going to end at some point.
Well, but
until then.
No, we're going to absolutely revisit this topic over the next 5 or 6 months, but I'll just end it with my experience with Comcast. You know, I was with them for 17 years. You know, one thing they have improved upon, and I think all of you guys would acknowledge this, especially you, Dwight, is they did a nice job of improving their customer support and experience. I mean, in the old days, you know, they were the butt of jokes, and they really did a nice job of improving their ability to service you from a support standpoint. The fascinating thing is that I think the deal that I had with them was I was getting a great rate, not only with 1.2 service down, and a very, very broad complement of premium content. I think I was paying $190-$195 a month. And when I called them, because my monthly rate jumped up to $250, you know, and I called them, said, you know, usually in the old days, they would have, oh yeah, we'll find another promotion for you. They didn't even put up a struggle. Their answer was, it's either $250 or you just don't.
Take it or leave it. Right. Right. That happened to me. That was one of the reasons why.
I was really surprised at that, Dwight. I was very surprised at that. Yeah. And nevertheless, you know, competition is always a good thing. I like to say that all the time. We will absolutely be revisiting this topic. And, you know, I'm just going to sit here over the weekend enjoying watching the Yankees and the Dodgers on MLB.com on the streaming service, because I can now see it on my 85-inch TV set. Anyway, guys, thanks for taking the time to join me for today's podcast. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of your day or commute. Please make sure that you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast, or use these on-screen QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Mark Vina Tech Guy. And until next time, have a great week. And guys, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.